today on building the open metaverse.
And how do you make the world not dense? We're pretty good at that as a field of, you know, within any one area, I can have, you know, essentially more polygons than pixels now. But how do I get the scope of doing cities and countries and planets? And that's everything from, you know, floating point precision breaking down to, you know, putting the world on non-planar surfaces. So you actually have a globe, and then dealing with physics where it has that scale where the domains don't have discrete boundaries, right? So simulating a river is sort of within video game tech today. Simulating an ocean is not. We only do a little strip right next to you, and there's no boundary if you simulate a whole planet. So that as the metaverse grows without bounds, all about scaling.
Welcome to Building the Open Metaverse, where technology experts discuss how the community is building the open metaverse together. Hosted by Patrick Cozy from Cesium and Mark Petit from Epic Games.
So welcome to our show, Building the Open Metaverse, the podcast where technologists share their insight on how the community is building the metaverse together. I'm Mark Petit from Epic Games, and my co-host is Patrick Cozy from Cesium. Patrick?
Thanks, Mark. Hello, everyone. We have a real treat today. With us is Morgan McGuire, the chief scientist at Roblox, leading research there. He's also an adjunct professor at University of Waterloo and McGill University. And Morgan, I was thinking about, you know, I followed you for many years and all the contributions you've made to the field. And this is our seventh episode of the podcast. And it's the first time I brought a prop. So I actually brought with me on the subway my copy of Computer Graphics, Principles and Practices. And you signed this along with five other of the authors at SIGGRAPH 2013. So very, very nice book. I also noticed that I'm on page 910 of it. Apparently, that's where my bookmark is. but, you know, former Roblox Morgan has made so many contributions to the field and has helped so many people like myself get into the field with the Journal of Computer Graphics Techniques, all your work with the i3D conference, Graphics Codex, you're teaching at Williams College, and then everything you stayed so pragmatic too with all the work you've done with game jams and posting everything too. And I think I've read every tweet that you've ever posted. So with that said, Morgan, we'd love to kick off and just hear more about your journey to the metaverse.
Well, bonjour. Hello. Thank you, guys. It's such an honor to be here with both of you. I think it's a mutual admiration society with Patrick and Mark and also, all the companies that we've each worked at. I'm a huge fan. And I think one of the great things about working in originally the entertainment industry, and now I think we all see the technology we're building as bigger than entertainment. Obviously, with Cesium, Patrick's work has gone there before us, but now with sort of building the metaverse and really all the ways that 3D technology can enable more than just games is really exciting. And I think one of the great things about working in this field is I work here, and I bet you do as well, because I want to use this stuff. I want to live in a future where there's cool VR and there's neat 3D stuff and everything is beautiful and has awesome interactions and I can do things that I can't do in the real world. And I want to participate in that just as a consumer, as a player, as a user. So it's great that we can be a part of helping to create that. But I've never lost being a fan of all the other folks who are doing such amazing things and just being in awe and inspired every day by their work. So thank you. That was a really nice introduction. I'm really honored you remember all those things I've done and worked on. And, right back at you, Patrick. I love everything you do. I love everything Mark does. And just honored to be here with you both.
Well, thank you. And you're right. You know, it's a fun community, and after many, many years, it's interesting to see that, you know, our collective work can make a big difference in our lives, in our kids' life. And I think we take this responsibility very, very seriously. And it's just one of the thrusts of having, you know, Patrick and I do this podcast about openness and making sure we create a metaverse that is open, something that we care a lot about. And I know you do too. So a nice segue into talking about, so you lead research at Roblox, right? So you're the guy looking down the road. So we're going to ask you a lot about, your predictions on how we get down the road. And one of the first topic that I remember we touched very rapidly back in July when we did the SIGGRAPH Birds of a Feather meeting was about the necessity to increase concurrency and get more people to interact on a single server. So what is your take on this? Roblox, one of the most advanced companies in that space. You have a background in NVIDIA as well. You know, what are the bottlenecks and how do we get to create that level of concurrency and making sure we have lots of people that can come together to share an experience?
Thanks for that question, Mark. It's definitely the biggest thing on my personal research agenda and very close to my heart and always has been, is the scaling problem. So at Roblox, we have three research groups. There's an applied data science group, which is similar to what other companies that have, large multiplayer games or social media for live ops, for monitoring our network, for health. But not the real-time aspect of that, but the analysis after the fact. And so really understanding how to optimize our platform. Then there's our user research group, which is all about design and human-computer interaction. And then we have this new fundamental research group, which I coordinate all three of these, but then I personally lead the fundamental research group. And that's more academic style. So similar to what we see from Adobe research or NVIDIA research, but places like that I really admire, where closely tied to product, but also very forward-looking and open with the community. So we're looking to publish a lot, to engage with colleagues at other companies, collaborators in academia, participate in academic conferences, because it's really about not the product today, but the next generation of the product. And within that fundamental research group, it itself has three different areas we work on. And you identified absolutely the first and most important to me, which is that notion of scaling number of players per server, for instance, the number of people you interact with. The other two areas that we're working on, which I'd love to come back to later, are natural language, everything about communication and moderation of voice and translation, and everything about user content creation. So how do we make it so that people can create things, put them out into the metaverse, and then be rewarded for their creations as well, is sort of an important part of that that we've all looked at with things like asset marketplaces and app stores. So scaling, communication, and creativity. And on the scaling side that you specifically asked about, there's a comment that Patrick actually made this summer. It's actually the same meeting that we were all in at SIGGRAPH. And Patrick made a joke, but it was completely true for all of us. He said, everybody's talking about the metaverse today, and that's in the popular press. I've been building this my whole life, and maybe I didn't know I was building it my whole life, but I now do. And it's definitely the case for me that the early sort of 80s, 90s science fiction influences, definitely that was what I wanted to build my whole life. I mean, that was it. That's what brought me to computer science, was exactly the stuff we're doing now. A true believer from day one and sort of virtual reality in all of its forms and that kind of bringing the world together through digital communication. But I also completely agree with I knew I wanted to build it, but I didn't know I was building it yet. I felt like I was working on adjacent fields. I felt like I was, I was working on video games. I was working on server scaling. I was working on all these things. And then it was only in the last two or three years that I think we collectively realized on the technology side, the world is ready for this. And I think the pandemic accelerated that, but the forces were coming before that. 20 years ago, the world wasn't really, like, people didn't understand why would you want video conferencing even, let alone why would you want full 3D interaction and simulation. And I think the world, like, users have gotten more sophisticated. People, we're all used to carrying phones, to having instant on video conferencing, to being able to manipulate with multi-touch. And a lot of people are now getting experienced in various kinds of 3D games. Everyone thinks of first-person shooters when you say 3D games. But I think what's been really democratizing is the explosive growth across the indie community, across consoles, other areas, of non-first-person shooter games. That was sort of the tech point that created this, with sort of Quake and Unreal and games like that were sort of how do you bring flight simulator tech to PC, when at the time all you could do was static environments and you run around and cast rays at each other. But I think now enough people have experienced all of the different kinds of interactions, whether it's, you know, things like Minecraft or that you can do in 3D, that now the world is ready for that technology. They're ready to be connected. They want more connectivity, and they want something better than what voice and text and video conferencing are giving them. So that's there. And then I think in the industry, we realize, oh, we're kind of there because we've gotten the scale. We can now do really large worlds. We can put a lot of players in worlds. It's pretty normal for shipping AAA games to have 100 players on a server instance now. 10 years ago, that was not possible. The networking infrastructure wasn't there. And with 5G and things coming, you know, as that rolls out, even the mobile infrastructure is getting good enough. So the main bottlenecks are everything about that N squared aspect, especially if you do voice. You have this, every player needs to know about every player, but when we have custom avatars, when we have custom animations for emotes, when we have a voice stream that isn't mixed globally, like voice chat has historically been in games, but is actually 3D embedded, and so everybody's hearing a slightly different mix, you somehow have to solve these N squared problems. And 3D graphics and simulation, we have all these methods for solving those. We build BSP trees and KD trees and grids and stuff. And now it's time to sort of bring those to bear on these problems of, for a school, for a virtual university, for augmented reality, where I'm walking around a real city, for a music concert, it suddenly makes sense to have more than 100 players, right? If they're all just doing a competition, right? So shooters or sports, or whatever, 100 makes sense as a limit. But if you have all the players in the audience watching the competition and they're in the same environment, suddenly tens of thousands make sense. Or if I'm in a city and the city really has 5 million people, if I want to lay the virtual twin in the metaverse on top of that, I need 1 million people in that server instance. They're not on shards. They're not, we need to manage that scale. So that's the scaling, I think, is first, everything around the player N squared aspect of making everyone real and interacting, not NPC crowds. And then secondarily, there's all the stuff which, you know, Patrick is far more of an expert than I am, in how do you make the world not dense? We're pretty good at that as a field of, you know, within any one area, I can have, you know, essentially more polygons than pixels now. But how do I get the scope of doing cities and countries and planets? And that's everything from, you know, floating point precision breaking down to, you know, putting the world on non-planar surfaces. So you actually have a globe, and then dealing with physics where it has that scale, where the domains don't have discrete boundaries, right? So simulating a river is sort of within video game tech today. Simulating an ocean is not. We only do a little strip right next to you, and there's no boundary if you simulate a whole planet. So that, as the metaverse grows without bounds, all about scaling.
Yeah. I mean, it's fascinating. I mean, but how do you think we go after this? I mean, is this like, do we just wait and Moore's Law is going to fix it for us, or are there any domain of research that you think are particularly promising?
So with a few exceptions, Moore's Law is not solving anything for anybody these days, right? So when we refer to Moore's Law, we're referring to Gordon Moore's economic observation that at Intel, every 2 years, he could sell twice as many transistors, right? So that there would be demand for computation scaling at that rate. And it turned out that if there's demand for something, the tech industry is pretty good at meeting that demand. And so Intel and then, you know, many, many others, and obviously AMD and NVIDIA are the huge chip manufacturers now as well. They found that, yeah, if people want to buy twice as many transistors every year or every 2 years, we're happy to give them to this. So the problem is Moore's Law was great for CPU style, single threaded, out of order execution, which essentially is benchmarks and nothing else today, right? To, you know, my web browser doesn't get out of bed without, you know, gigabytes of memory and 1,000 threads or something. And, you know, on one hand, it's not my favorite feature of most software today, that it needs those kind of resources. I'm sort of old school demo scene hacker style programmer, and, you know, it seems like 64K should be, you know, more than enough for anything still, probably 4K if you're really serious. But in practice, it's all about parallelism, right? So, and especially everything in our space. So all of the simulation, all of the graphics, all of the audio mixing, and not having anything block on resources. So talking to the network where you're, you know, networking is no longer, I send the state of the game across my local network 60 times a second. It's, we're talking to multiple content delivery networks. You're, you know, doing clever things as you go through cell towers and base stations. You're routing in complicated ways. In many cases, we need to have these communications be encrypted, either to, you know, prevent cheating or protect privacy of the players. And so all of that is, you know, many, many threaded queues just for the networking. Same for the graphics, right? We have a CPU and a GPU, and we don't want them to stall on each other. So everything is huge buffers and threads. And so I think Moore's Law in the classic sense of, can I, my CPU will get more transistors and a higher clock speed, and therefore I don't have to change my algorithms. I think that's been dead for probably 10 years completely. However, Moore's Law in terms of the economic observation that roughly every 2 years, and I think we're actually doing better than this in the last couple of years, the amount of computation I can get at sort of a fixed price is doubling. That seems really strong, and it's largely because of parallelism, especially in GPUs. And then now we've kind of hit the limit on how many transistors you can pack into a single package. And so I think we're starting to see multi-package devices. It's sort of bringing back multi-processor, right? Multi-threading kind of killed the multi-processor for a while. And but now we're seeing, I want more cores than you can fit in a single chip. And so multi-processor, I think, is back. And in a data center, that's the entire world. It's everything is an application that runs across thousands of processors and multiple nodes with very high-speed network interconnects. So I think absolutely we're going to get the scaling. But the difference, and this is what changed 10 years ago, when Moore's Law was scaling as the CPU gets faster on a single thread, I don't change my algorithm, right? I mean, there was still great algorithm development going on, obviously, you know, well into the 2000s and today. But the Moore's Law speed up, I got that for free on top of my algorithm. And I was trying to get an extra speed up on top of that by changing the algorithm. Today, if you don't change your algorithm, your program will not run any faster on newer hardware in many cases. And it may run slower because if the newer hardware has more cores that are clocked slower and you're not taking advantage of those cores, that's going to be a problem. And it also, it's not about money today. Chips are, you know, the raw materials are free, even though it costs a lot to develop them. So you pay a lot for your processor, of course. But power management, whether it's mobile and it's on battery and you're trying to avoid thermal throttling or get longer life, or it's data center where you have to physically pump all that heat out of the data center and provide the energy, or just the general concern of we want all of our computations to, you know, to be as eco-friendly as possible and sustainable. So we want to be efficient. So that's the challenge. And so the question I think becomes, within a fixed or shrinking power envelope, how do I get twice the performance every 2 years or better? And that's 100%. You have to co-evolve software and hardware. So you have to change your algorithms completely every couple of years. And we've seen this from all the companies in the industry doing innovation on that space. For me, the server side is the big one, because that's going to be the heart of the metaverse, is all the data sitting in the server. And we have to get super efficient about that as a field.
So Morgan, this is super interesting, because I think twice now on the podcast, we've had this topic of hybrid architectures come up, and what do you run on the server? What do you run on the client? And how does that maybe change over time? So, I mean, I'd love to hear your perspective on that.
I think it's definitely changing a lot over time. So the server side from a developer's perspective is wonderful, right? You control the server. You can roll out homogeneous hardware everywhere. You know exactly when you're going to upgrade it, and you know you can tie everything to that. So the server side, we're very confident about at Roblox, and we're doing a lot of interesting stuff going forward in that space, and it's sort of a centerpiece of our research agenda. The client side is tricky, and that's been really interesting watching how the product side of the company deals with that. For Roblox, it's been really important to provide accessibility to the metaverse, and accessibility comes in many forms. It means the applications in your language, right? It's available in your region, in your country. It means that the application can map to different devices. So if you have either different physical abilities or you're doing different tasks, VR, you know, I could go out and get a Quest headset or whatever. I don't really want to wear that on a city bus. That's kind of antisocial, and it's probably not even safe to be wearing a VR headset as you're hurtling around the city. So accessibility in that context means showing up on your phone with the same, you know, or not the same experience, but with an opportunity to participate in the same VR space with people who are on different devices. So some are in VR, some are on console, some are on desktop, some are on phone. And phones are absolutely, especially the sort of mid-range phones, is the most interesting end because there's such a diversity of devices and they radically vary by country and by ability. And the phone is ultimately also limited by, you know, not just its processor, but its RAM and its network connectivity. So spanning all of those client devices is really challenging. And it's only going to get more challenging because the old ones don't go away. In fact, you know, many of our users at Roblox are people who are on a hand-me-down phone, right? They're a teenager or a child, and so they're using their parents' previous gen phone or the phone that they bought used. And we want to support those people and give them the best experience we can. And so we can't say, you know, you need this year's iPhone in order to use our platform. We have to make sure that there's some way to map the experience appropriately for them. And that's really challenging because, you know, sometimes there are bugs in the drivers and they're never going to get fixed. They have, you know, really limited capabilities. And something a friend of mine who's now at Roblox as well, Angelo Pesci, said to me that just completely changed my mind about everything in the metaverse from the visual side was he said, we're not rendering the metaverse. What he sees his team doing at Roblox is giving you a visualization of the metaverse. And so it's not, and this is kind of like you see this in movies, right? Like in The Matrix, when they have the, you know, the famous green text scroll, that's one of many visualizations. And the ultimate visualization in that movie series is, of course, going in the sort of full body immersive VR. But the notion that there could be, that somebody can call into the metaverse, that they're not even in 3D, they're making a phone call, or that somebody is seeing kind of a data dump that they know how to interpret, and that's the green scrolling text. That's really important. And so when you look at the problem that way, not that we're trying to render the metaverse on a, you know, mid-range hand-me-down Android phone in somewhere, but that the problem is we're trying to say, well, given the capabilities of that device, what's the best window we can create of a visualization of that experience in the metaverse, that's kind of tractable then, because you're not asking the phone to do anything it couldn't have done 10 years ago. You're just feeding it new data from the cloud. And I think it's the case that, and this sort of implied in your question, if you're on a lower end device, you might be getting a lot more server side processing doing the heavy lifting. The extreme end that some companies have gone to, which I think is a really interesting space, is it might be 100%. Your phone might be playing back video that's being dynamically rendered. And of course, there's all kinds of latency and sort of interactivity and bandwidth reasons why that might not be the best solution everywhere. But that's a really interesting extreme. And the other extreme is maybe you have this monster desktop with the, you know, you have a Valve Index and six NVIDIA GPUs in it. And in that case, the server might be doing very little for you. You might be completely duplicating all of the 3D simulation, everything, to give you the absolute lowest latency, because that's important for the experience, and you have that hardware available to you. So there's big balance, but the heterogeneity of clients, I think, is really interesting, and it's a design challenge to figure out how do you work with that kind of diversity.
Yeah, and we know it's about to get worse with wearables, right? Where we have like a hierarchy of wearables, phones, and edge, and then the big scale. So do you think our software architectures are ready to handle that three, four, 5-tier compute environment.
Yeah, certainly anybody's software architecture today is ready to handle, especially the sort of, you know, AR see-through head-mounted displays, because that combines, it has even tighter latency constraints than VR, because you, in VR, you can't see the real world. So there's all kinds of things where if things are misregistered, they can affect your senses, and sort of, you know, there's your visual cortex and all of your sense of balance in your inner ear. But you don't have a reference point in VR beyond gravity. And so you can get away with things sliding a little. In AR, the magic is gone if the virtual character slips inside of a wall because I'm on a bicycle and they're bouncing up and down. It has to be perfectly registered to the real world. And so you have to have super, super tight latency requirements on just the display aspect. And then obviously the scalability, that becomes huge because you need everything from the real world. Real world has to be not necessarily replicated, but the virtual world has to be aware of it to avoid things, you know, getting occlusions incorrect and get the interactions to be meaningful. So I don't think anyone's infrastructure today can handle that. That's why we have a research department at Roblox, is to make sure that when those are widespread devices, and, you know, maybe that'll be 2 years from now, which I would love. And, you know, maybe it'll be 10 or 15 years, which I'm just happy that's still hopefully in my lifetime. I think we're all investing in figuring out how do we scale up to get to that. We only just crossed the threshold of this sort of infinite visual detail is okay. And we're just starting to edge up on the notion of infinite scope of geometry. So getting planet scale stuff. And no one in the field is near getting, you know, 10,000, 50,000 players on a single server instance in real time. There are games like EVE Online that can do it, but then they run at 1 frame per second when that's happening. So, you know, we want to do that at, you know, life starts at 60 and goes up very quick, especially in, you know, the wearables range. So, you know, doing it 120 or 240 hertz is kind of where we need to be. So I like those orders of magnitude challenges, but I think no one's quite ready for that. I think we're all doing a really good job. There's a lot of good tech for desktop and phones today. And as we scale up number of players, that'll be stressed. And the new displays, I think, will give us a really exciting challenge that I'm looking forward to.
So let's come back, you know, on communication. You know, what we like about the metaverse is social first. Is, you know, we do stuff with the people we like, hopefully, mostly with the people we like. And so you started to talk about natural language processing. And so, you know, so we're all talking to our machines now. It's kind of, it took me some time. I'm old class, you know, but I accept to talk to the machines in my home now. So where is this going as well from your perspective? How do we make a much richer experience using natural language processing?
So it's interesting that you mentioned this following discussion on wearables, because I think that's what's really going to ultimately push it, is as soon as you have, so if you have a head-mounted display, and there's some really interesting ones, like Bose, I think, had an audio-only one, right? So it was a wearable display, but it kind of, and it knew where it was in 3D, but sidesteps some of the visual stuff. And there's been lots of amazing work. You know, every year it's a graph. You see all these cool emerging technology wearable displays. And there's a couple that are, you know, you can go out and buy them on the market today for sort of see-through AR experience. There's no mouse, there's no keyboard, there's no touchscreen. The only interface that makes sense is voice and gesture at that point. So definitely, that's going to push, I think, really hard on that humans communicating with machines part. And at that point, it kind of has to work, because you don't even want to have, you know, when you talk to your phone, it pops up a confirmation dialogue. Or even when I'm using voice activation in my car, it wants a verbal affirmation that it got things right. And I don't think that makes sense to have every single, you know, when that's your only interaction, you're not just saying play music, but you're checking your calendar, you're scheduling things, you know, maybe you're programming by describing things with natural language. It doesn't make sense at that point to have it ask for confirmation on everything. So it has to be all voice. So that'll be really interesting. I think that augmented reality will sort of force the issue on human and machine natural language communication. For human-human communication, which is foremost where in our research lab at Roblox, where we're working today on the natural language problems, I think that's an in some sense, it's an easier problem because you don't have to solve the cognition, right? Machines can translate and process audio that they don't understand. So I don't think anyone believes that no one would consider the translation services, the natural language text translation services we use today, to be intelligent in the sense of generalized intelligence and cognition, right? So they can translate, extremely well from, English to French, for example. And they have no idea what they're translating, of course. It's just they know how to do the process. And largely those are supervised learning systems, which were, to give another shout out to Mark and I in Canada. Canada had this great supervised learning training set of all official documents are in both English and French. And so as a result, it's a perfect mapping from which you can train systems. So all the natural language translation was sort of initially trained on that, and then it went out to supervised learning on other corpuses from other languages. But that was kind of a neat thing. And I think it's one of the reasons that the English to French is particularly good in French to English for machine translation. So it's not intelligent, though. It's not understanding. And I think we would like to be able to do that on voice. I think we can do that. I think that's a really important part for the metaverse, is to be able to connect people who are speaking different natural languages, but doing it by voice, not forcing them into a text interface. So today on Roblox, we machine translate a lot of things. So if you put a sign in a world, so you're creating an experience, you put up a little street sign or some instructions, we will automatically translate that in the product into all the languages that it's deployed in. And so that's kind of neat. So you can, developers don't have to be particularly sophisticated about localization on their own, like you would for a AAA game. And the system can kind of do heavy lifting. And you can imagine text chat. You could pipe that through Google Translate or something. In text translation, you don't really care about the latency because the text takes a while to type in and a while to read, and it costs almost nothing to transfer. And so as a result, it's okay if you spend a second translating text. No one's going to really mind that. When you get to voice, you lose the interactivity component, and it's more expensive to compress and transmit. So you've already lost time off the top to the network, to the latency of transmitting it. And so what we're targeting currently is we want to, within 250 milliseconds, we have research projects to try and do natural language translation. And this is probably not, this is not something that will magically solve in the next year or two or three even. I think it'll be decades probably until we get real-time natural language translation with voice fonts. So the translation could be in your voice, or it could be in some assumed voice of your avatar. That has moderation on top of that, so that we can avoid certain kinds of abuse or toxic actions. That's a very, very long-term problem. But in our lab, we're trying to do the first steps of that, because that notion of safety and translation, internationalization, that's been core to Roblox's vision of the metaverse. And so as we move into voice, and that's an area where the emerging tech in that is not as strong as it is for text. There's some cool results in research from universities, but they're, it runs for 10 seconds of an offline process. It's not at all real time. So that's for the natural language side where we're focusing. And we hope that within the next few years, we'll be able to make some pretty big contributions to the state of the art for everyone in natural language voice translation.
That's fascinating. And I hugely important. I guess I did not anticipate that there would be such a complex problem. So hopefully you guys figure something out there. And so you mentioned the third kind of aspect, and I do agree that the metaverse is all about moving from an era when we like and we watch to an era when we partake and we create and we have agency over content. So, and empowering creators is one of the, I think, a common theme that we see across, across many companies right now. So how do you envision this at Roblox?
Yeah, so thank you for asking about the creativity. And I think that gets also to the heart of openness, which is something that the three of us really care about, and obviously this podcast. I was recently reflecting with a bunch of friends about just within my lifetime, watching how technology and content, digital content creation became more accessible. And with an eye towards this sort of, building blocks of the metaverse space, I was thinking about an internship in high school. I was really fortunate. I grew up in the town where IBM Research had two of its labs. And so I had an internship in high school there. And so I was, you know, one of the first people from sort of outside of classic academia who got to experience pre-web and then the web, you know, sort of the original Netscape Navigator and all of that technology. And that was huge, right? Of democratizing content creation that anybody could just make text and images and documents. And it wasn't, and that's like the creation aspect of creation. It was the whole authoring package of you could distribute it. Suddenly I could make a document that anybody in the world could see. And it cost me, you know, almost nothing. That was sort of the first time that people had that level of, you know, global scope from your bedroom as a content creator. And I'm really sorry to see that the way the web has evolved. I mean, the web is great today. I mean, they use it for everything. But things like GeoCities and MySpace that, you know, we kind of make fun of now as big communities that were a little hokey and their design sense was off. That to me was so special, and I missed that there were these large communities of people who found each other online, who were just, you know, they're really into knitting and they're really, you know, whatever. And you can put that stuff out, and that's largely gone from the web. That kind of you know, folk art aspect of the web is gone. And then when app stores came, you know, with Apple's app store, but now we've VR app stores and multiple video game app stores and desktop apps, you know, arguably maybe too many app stores for most people. But from the perspective of small developers, you know, medium and all the way down to indie, that was, again, it was a way that you could create interactive content and you could sell it on a global scale, right? So the web let me put content out there, but there was no way to monetize. There's no way to reward the content creator. And there was no kind of quality control or security or gatekeeping, which for an application you really want. You want someone to have at least vetted that this thing isn't going to destroy your phone when you download it. And so the app store is really for individual professionals, so not for students, not for hobbyists, because the barrier to entry is a little too high for the app stores today. But it suddenly meant a lot more people could create content and share it and now be rewarded. And I'm also really into this kind of niche scene that I don't know if you guys are into. Have you used fantasy consoles like Pico 8? Are you familiar with this? So fantasy, this is the coolest thing. And I only found out about this a few years ago. A fantasy console. So you know how we have emulators for retro hardware, right? So like, you know, my original SNES, you know, gave up the ghost a long time ago. But you could get an emulator, and then if you had a scan of the ROM from when you did actually own the device, you could play it on a modern PC. So it's a PC emulating an older piece of hardware, which is easy for because it's a lot more powerful. So the fantasy consoles, I believe, originated with Joseph White, who goes by Lexilawful, and he created this thing called Pico 8, which is he made an emulator for an 8-bit retro hardware where there was no hardware. He just made the emulator. And he made a whole IDE that ran on top of the emulator. So you go into this 128 by 128 window, and you have 16 colors. And the entire IDE, like you code, you draw everything within this 128 by 128 pixel world. And you can make these games. And it's programmed in Lua. And so between having like a scripting language, providing you all the dev tools, and there's a way to publish games from within it. So then it's kind of like a console, like a modern console app store, but anybody can participate. But it runs on this emulator, so it's safe to download things because they're in a sandbox. That really democratized interactive content creation for 2D. You can hack 3D in sort of old school ways, and people do, but it's primarily a sprite-based 2D thing. And then from that, there's a bunch of other consoles that came that weren't 120 by 128, they're a little more modern. So Tic-80 is one of them. There's a project I run with a bunch of friends called QuadPlay, which is sort of a more modern, runs in a web browser version of this thing. And those fantasy consoles solved the deployment problem. They really meant anybody could get in. You could make a video game. You could make your, you know, Space Invaders inspired thing and share it with the world. Most of them, there's a little bit through itch.io, but most of them don't have a good way to monetize. So that was a step backwards from the commercial app stores. And then Metaverse is kind of version one, which is sort of 2003 through now. There was Club Penguin, Roblox shipped around the same time, Second Life. All those kind of things showed up early 2000s when they all shipped. And most of those haven't scaled well. So Roblox is kind of the only one standing, but it wasn't the first mover. There were a lot of people in the space doing a lot of cool things. And I think we've all learned from that. And now there's sort of a second wave coming, right? Of Roblox is now increasing its scale dramatically, but also other companies are now entering that space. And we've all kind of learned from each other. And that, to me, is really democratizing 3D content creation. That notion that anybody can make an avatar, or maybe you can't do 3D modeling, but you can paint a texture and put it on a shirt and you can sell that, that we can have some notion of protecting uniqueness so that you can do limited editions, so that you can be guaranteed that no one else is stealing the content you've produced, so that you can do derivative works in an interesting sort of, how do I get a royalty if you use my texture on this outfit that you put out? Right? I don't want to block you, but I want my cut from that. So that's all super interesting. And then getting them all to interoperate with the whole tools ecosystem. So how do I make it so that I don't have to use, maybe I want to be on one company's asset store, but I don't want to use that company's tools. I have some other tools I like. So how do I create in one tool and then export? And this has been a classic problem in 3D, but it was only for professionals was it a problem until recently, because no one was creating 3D content except professionals. And so they could solve the interop problem by having engineers go off and spend a year writing an exporter or an importer, or adjusting the whole engine. Now that we're starting to see everyone making content, whether it's something as simple as an emote or a voice sample, or as complicated as an entire 3D interactive world, that interop problem is going to be an issue. And so I think there's a lot of interesting ways to start looking at that. It's early days. There aren't that many tools you can use. There aren't that many metaverse platforms. But just moving in that direction is super interesting. And I think the first one is making it so you can connect any tool to any asset store is the first step. And as we were talking before we started the podcast recording, Roblox has since announced we have OpenCloud. And what we did is we made it so that the APIs that Studio, our 3D IDE, that it uses, we're releasing them all publicly. And so essentially Studio becomes not the only way to create content for Roblox, what it traditionally had been, but merely a reference implementation of one way. And you can make a plugin, or you can write a Python script, or whatever you want to directly access the robot asset, the Roblox asset cloud, and upload and download content. And that to me is a really exciting first step to the notion of putting more and more tools together.
Are you guys looking at supporting open format like GLTF or USD or any of those?
Yeah, that's a great question. So currently we do a lot of our import in FBX, which prior to USD, so USD was sort of used internally by Pixar for a while, and it only became public in the last couple of years, and then it only became really actively supported and embraced very recently. So Autodesk had a proprietary format called FBX,
and which you know very well.
Yeah, which we know very well. And, I have a complicated relationship with FBX. So it did certain things really well, and then there were other things where it either didn't meet my needs or it wasn't open enough for me to be able to extend it to meet my needs. And so we've been using that because that interacts well with sort of the existing tools from the professional ecosystem. But I'm personally very excited about the potential to look at USD as either an alternative or replacement or whatever. Those aren't my decisions to make, right? I'm just a researcher. But in the research side, I definitely use USD a lot, and that's a great way to get interop with a huge number of tools, and increasingly a bunch of asset stores starting to move in that direction. So I think there's some limitations to USD as deployed, as with any format. And so I think those are exciting areas where I'd love to engage on sort of fixing some of those limitations and see how we can help out, because it's a very exciting format. I think there's a lot to be done on that space.
So Morgan, it's been super inspiring and fun to have you on the show today. And we'd love to wrap up by asking all of our guests if there's any person or organization they'd like to give a shout out to.
Oh man, that's like you know, when you didn't expect to win the Grammy, and then you're on stage and you have like 1,000 people. So I mean, obviously there's, you know, Roblox was built by I think we have 1,200 people right now, and there have been many others who've, you know, come and gone in the past, and so all of the great stuff at Roblox is, you know, That's me being today a voice for the work of many, many others that I you know, want to make that clear, that where that innovation has come from and is going to continue to come from is not me, but me helping others with those great ideas. But I just want to, you know, I want to thank you, Patrick and Mark. And of course, you know, we have to always give a shout out to Eric Haynes, who introduced us many years
ago. Yes.
And all the other folks in the field who are just, you know, it's the students, it's the people who are writing the textbooks, the people who are posting all that great content on Twitter. You know, there's a few of us who are fortunate to be at the stages of our career, like the three of us, where we get to channel some of that innovation directly into products, and, you know, we're all friends and get to go and give these talks. But really, I feel like the metaverse is, you know, we are setting the stage for the people who are really going to make the metaverse, right? Who are going to make that next level. And it's that 12-year-old, you know, bedroom coder, 3D artist today, or the undergrad in their first graphics class who's asking us questions on Twitter. So, I don't really want to give a shout out to all my, you know, so-called famous friends. I want to give a shout out to all those people who engage with us publicly. That's where I get new ideas, and that's what gives me so much hope for the future of the metaverse. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Morgan. Very, very nice to know. I think it's great to see that shout out, and the new generation, you know, they're going to expect, they will want the metaverse to work. I mean, they're born with so much more expectation than we were. Yeah, so fantastic. Well, I want to thank you so much for your time. You've been very generous. It's fantastic to have you with us. You know, we created this podcast to have the people who are actually doing it talk about it to their fellow builders and pioneers, and it was fantastic. So I want to thank our audience. You know, we hear more and more people are listening and joining the podcast, and I think with this episode, it's going to be another high point for us. Thank you, Morgan. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Patrick. And as we say in those circumstances, if you like it, subscribe, rate, review, talk about it, tell us what you think, tell us how we can do better. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Morgan. Bye-bye.